Good morning.
Good morning.
When you listen to WUNC and it lists its broadcast locations across North Carolina, the last one it mentions is Welcome. And that's always seemed ironic to me because Welcome could compete to be the least intellectual place in North Carolina. And I know that because I grew up there. I'm the product of two proud Piedmont clans, the Leonards of Davidson County and the Bogers of Davie. My ancestral patriarchs on both sides arrived on the creek banks on which we still live over 250 years ago with not much to show for it. As a bit of an adolescent smart aleck, I would occasionally say, how could we have been here so long and have so little? I grew up amidst grandparents, 16 sets of aunts and uncles, and dozens of cousins, and no one had ever attempted college before me. My parents did not want me to come to this godless communist school. They wanted me to go to a good church school like Duke or Davidson. Needless to say, my family was politically conservative. My paternal grandmother took a grandchild with her into the voting booth to show her where to put her X on the straight Republican ticket. My teetotaling maternal grandparents supported the Republican sheriff of Davie County long after he lost his license and to multiple DWIs and had to be driven around by his sole deputy. When I attempted to register to vote as a Democrat, the clerk said sternly, "Wait right here, I've got to go get Miss Craver." Miss Craver ran the Davidson County Board of Elections. She said, "Son, does your daddy know you're doing this? No one in your family has ever registered as a Democrat in this county." My parents changed their tune about Carolina when the Moorhead Scholarship came my way. In one of those coincidences that change your life, I was always glad that the letter from Duke awarding me the Andrew B. Duke came the next week, saving me from that unimaginable fate. But I went to Carolina convinced I had gotten the Moorhead by mistake, and they were going to take it back. This was confirmed in the first day of my English honors class when we were told to read the entire Odyssey before the next class, and the preppy next to me nonchalantly said, "In English or Greek?" But my terror reached new heights midway through the semester when one night all of my buddies who were Moorheads started pulling their tuxes out to go to the freshman banquet I knew nothing about. Although I had rarely left the library to that point, now I really doubled down. And I found out years later what happened. The J in my name stands for my first name, Jerry, which I never use. But there was another Jerry Leonard on campus at that time, an impoverished law student. And although he had no idea why he was invited, a free meal was a free meal. So he took my invitation and went. Spring of my freshman year, I decided it was time to get more involved, and I ran for the student legislature from Morrison Dorm on the university party ticket and won. That decision had consequences. For in the fall of my sophomore year, Charlie Mercer, who many of you know, who was the vice president and the speaker of the student legislature, announced that he was solving his existential crisis, we all had them in those days, by dropping out of school and driving to California. I threw my hat in the ring against a very popular senior, and we tied 25-25 in the vote, giving Charlie, who does like a stage, the chance to pick his successor. He finally picked me, but only after an endless oration in which he addressed most of the problems in his personal life and of the world. That fall was the cafeteria workers' strike. I'd come to know some of the workers because they were the only people on campus who seemed like the folks at home. And the more we talked, the more I came to see things their way. I joined the picket lines, and I became part of a coordinating committee of students, organizing support for them. One morning, everywhere I went, there was a message that President Friday wanted to see me immediately. I went to his office, and he told me that he was afraid that Governor Scott was about to do something rash, And he wanted a student to go talk to him to explain that the campus was calm and under control. I said, when? And he said, right now. I drove to Raleigh from his office. I was ushered in, and I sat with Governor Scott for an hour, one-on-one, and I thought it went well. That night, Governor Scott invoked the public insurrection provision of the North Carolina Constitution and declared martial law on the campus. We awoke to several hundred armed National Guardsmen lining the sidewalks. Next time I saw President Friday, he said, that didn't go like I hoped. I just shrugged. The worker strike gave me my first exposure to the power of law. On the first day of the strike, a number of black students on campus had gone through Lenoir Hall, turning over tables and chairs to make it clear that the dining halls were closed. The racist history professor who chaired the faculty committee on scholarships decided he knew how to end this, so he immediately started proceedings to revoke the scholarships of all of the students who'd been involved in the Lenoir Hall incident. The hearings were private, but that was when the university was experimenting with putting students on faculty committees, and I was the student on the faculty scholarship committee and could not be excluded from the hearings. I was horrified by what was happening. I was only at Carolina because of my scholarship, and I knew these students were in the same boat. And not knowing what else to do, I went over to the law school and I asked to talk to Dean Berg, who I had met on one prior occasion. I told him I didn't know the law of it, but I couldn't believe what was happening was right. And I, in fact, knew that much worse property damage happened every Saturday night in fraternity court, and nobody was taking away those scholarships. He noncommittally, as a good lawyer, said he would look into it. The next morning, when the hearings resumed, Dean Byrd walked into the room. He asked to speak to the chairman in the hall. A few minutes later, the chairman returned red-faced and announced that the hearings were suspended indefinitely, and we never heard any more about it. Now, incidentally, the chairman got his revenge. He was also the advisor to Phi Beta Kappa, and then the tradition was that the student with the highest GPA at the end of your junior year became president your senior year. My year, three of us were tied. And he gleefully informed me that in the privacy of his office with no one looking, he had tossed a coin twice and I'd lost both times, so I was the secretary. That sophomore year was when I moved into the orbit of the legendary Ann Queen, the director of the Campus Y, who was the conscience of the university. I became her regular houseboy at her famous Saturday night soirees. And there I met folks for the first time, like Tom Lambert and Martha McKay, Howard Lee, John Sanders, and critically, Joel Fleischman. Ann said to him in her blunt way, "This boy needs to go to Yale Law School, and I expect you to make it happen." I watched President Friday and Senator Ralph Scott, the governor's uncle, settle the worker strike on her sofa late one Saturday night. After the turmoil of my sophomore year, I came back to campus my junior year expecting things to be quieter. But then President Nixon, rather than ending the Vietnam War as promised, bombed Cambodia, and campuses across the country exploded. Wib Gully, who was a Duke student, and I went to the airport to pick up Jack Newfield, the legendary columnist for the Village Voice, who was speaking at protest rallies on both campuses. The lead story in the Village Voice the next week went condescendingly like this: if tall blonde boys with thick drawls from Little Rock and Welcome are leading the protests, this thing is over. In the spring of my junior year, I did not do what everyone expected. My friend Tom Bellow and I agreed that he would run for student body president, and I would throw in my hat to be president of the Carolina Union. Although the president had the bully pulpit, the union president had the enormous budget and control of concerts, movies, speakers, and events. In most ways, it was a wonderful year. I got to hang out with and introduce Chicago, Ike and Tina Turner, Richie Havens, and John Sebastian. W.H. Auden came for a poetry reading, And I was able to bring my high school English teacher, who I give credit for standing here today, to Chapel Hill to have dinner with him. There were hitches. I had agreed with Preston Dobbins, who was my friend who was the head of the Black Student Movement, that I would pay for a speaker of his choosing and we would co-sponsor the speech. He chose Stokely Carmichael, and I invited him. The chancellor summoned me to South Building, and he told me to withdraw the invitation, and I declined. And I said to him, you know, I know, Chancellor, you can overrule me, but do you really want us all marching around again this year? Stokely came, and he made an uneventful speech. For all of my successes, my days at Carolina ended in ignominy. I'm the guy who killed Jubilee. In many ways, what happened nationally in the transition from Woodstock to Altamont happened on our campus. Prior to my year, Jubilees were lighthearted spring festivals attended only by students and their dates. My year, folks began to bring us flyers from headshops up and down the East Coast saying, come to Jubilee. Folks descended on Chapel Hill from all over the country in the week before. None of our security systems worked as mobs rushed the gates. The straw bales used as seating for the bluegrass stage were set on fire. Dozens of people were treated in the first aid tent for drug overdoses. I learned again about the power of the law as neighbors got a temporary restraining order that Howard Henry, the union director, and I were to be arrested if the music was not over by 12. Try telling that to the Allman Brothers. I was just mostly relieved no one died. After it was over, I told Mr. Henry I needed to end it on my watch or it would ruin my successor's term. So I met with the chancellor and the union, and he issued a joint statement that Jubilee was done, and I slunk out of Chapel Hill. The rest of the story is beyond my task for today. In two sentences, I did go to Yale Law School. I did come back to North Carolina to clerk for the legendary federal trial judge in Raleigh, Frank Dupree. I practiced law for a while with Senator Sanford's law firm. I returned to the federal courts in a variety of positions that ended up with 20 years as a judge on the federal bankruptcy court before I decided to become a law school dean. 4 years ago, I am married to an extraordinary woman. I'm the proud father of 5 children stretched across 30 years, and it continues to be a charmed life. I owe it to this place. I came here as an unformed rube, and I left with confidence in my intellect, with my ability to lead, but most importantly, with the sophisticated set of moral values that I developed here that have never led me astray. Thank you.